Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Peter Bogdjo. Early in his life, Peter decided he was an actor, identified as an actor, worked to become a better and better actor, only to discover that his skills and his inclinations were in another direction, which he then followed. And then his life took yet another turn. Listen to this charming, articulate, self-deprecating man talk about what it is like to follow your path, the path that is best for you, which may not be the first one that you found or even the second one. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
is about being the person you really are, not the person that you think you have to be in order to be liked, loved, accepted, hired, not the person that other people are, not the person that other people told you you had to be or even told you you were, not even the person you currently think you are, but the person you really are. Unfortunately, too many people have experiences in their childhood that tell them that something about them is not all right. Something about them causes criticism or causes them to be embarrassed, even punished. And when that happens, we quite quickly learn how to dissemble, how to pretend that that thing isn't really true of us, how to hide it, and many get so good at the hiding that they come into adulthood having forgotten important things about themselves. And while this is often necessary to get us through our childhood, it's a serious limitation for an adult. And you can see that pretending that you're not as smart as you are, or pretending that you're not as funny as you are, or pretending that you don't really like to draw or dance, or you have some other inclination which others disapproved of, not only cheats you out of the pleasure you could be getting from them, but it feels bad. So the Lynn Show is about saying that if this happened to you, or even if you suspect that it happened to you, it may not be a life sentence. And if you want to talk to me about how you recover some of the things you might have lost, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com. thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And the interview I'm airing today with Peter Bojo demonstrates what it sounds like when you are someone who is willing, as we say later in the show, to switch horses midstream, to recognize that the person you thought you were, the thing you thought you wanted to do, may not actually be the perfect fit for you. And that your experiences, if you are open to truly understanding what they say about you, can lead you to leave who you thought you were and become who you are. Listen to Peter talk about discovering that he is actually a fish. It's a wonderful story of someone who has the courage to pursue himself and thereby become more and more and more of himself. I'm not going to tell you any more about it because Peter tells it better. And so here now is Peter Bojo. I'm here with Peter Bojo. And I'm interviewing Peter about his book, which is Broadway General Manager, Demystifying the Most Important and Least Understood Role in Show Business. So I'm explaining to Peter that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, the art to which you have given your life is theater?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. All right, good. So I only ask one question, and it is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first time in your life that theater, performance, stories, any of that, called you, attracted you, interested you?
Yes. When I was 5 years old, in kindergarten, our teacher decided to put on a non-dancing, mercifully, production of The Nutcracker. And I was cast as the Nutcracker.
Wow.
Thinking back, this probably had a lot to do with my being the tallest in the class.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I just assumed that I must have some very special talent because it was called The Nutcracker, and I was the Nutcracker.
Yes, and you remember thinking that it was significant?
I just remember loving the experience, the excitement of being in a show. That's when I fell in love.
Yeah,
I fell in love with the theater. And for many years I thought that my calling was to be a performer.
Well, hold on. We'll get there. It's, you know, I'm watching you and I can see you reliving it, essentially. So those experiences, those early experiences that are so powerful that we can touch them so many years later, right? That's, in my experience, lots of people have those things that happen to them, but they don't or aren't able to hold on to them, use them, find them later, but apparently you did in some way.
That was my initial exposure. I would say the most significant sort of childhood experience
mm-hmm.
occurred when I was in eighth grade, and we did a production of Oliver, the musical, and I was cast as Fagin.
Mm.
And that was a big success in our little community in junior high. In fact, our either the director or the music teacher, who were both wonderful, it was so successful that they arranged for us to make our own LP cast recording, which I still have.
Wow.
And so that was terribly exciting. Here I was on a cast recording at the age of 12 or something, singing Fagin. Again, I was probably the tallest in the class. But I have to laugh, if I ever go back for a high school reunion like 30 years later, someone will still come up to me and say, I still remember your Fagin.
That's amazing.
Which is so sweet.
It's wonderful. So you sing?
I sing. I do.
Yes. Okay. So were there singing lessons, acting lessons, dancing lessons, any of that?
Minimal. Certainly no acting. There was a brief period where I took some tap dancing lessons because I thought I would see old Hollywood movies, Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, and I thought, oh, it might be really useful to tap dance. And
okay, hold on. How old were you when you did?
Maybe 15.
Okay, so you were already thinking performer.
Yes, yes. There was a part of me that wanted to be a performer, definitely.
Do you remember, was there a moment? Or was it just, wow, this is terrific, I'd like to do this? I mean, was it that, or was it, I'd like to do this with my life, or did you know there were performers? I mean, did you know it was a career?
I did know. Somehow, I was very fortunate within our little community and our little school system. I almost always got the lead in whatever, whether it was a musical or a play. So it kind of became part of my identity.
Yeah.
I was the actor.
So at some point, you stopped blaming it on your height.
Yes, at some point, the audition itself must have...
And there were auditions. Did you audition for Fagin, or they...
I must have. What I remember clearly was the next year. In those days, the school system was organized a little differently than now. My community had a junior high school, and then high school, we didn't have middle school, which seems to be the standard now. But, so... I did Fagin in eighth grade at the end of junior high, and the next year in ninth grade I was a freshman in high school, a different building, different teachers, and a good friend of mine who also had been an offer and always loved performing and I both auditioned for the high school play, and the two of us got the leads, and it caused something of a scandal. There were some very disgruntled seniors who thought that it was, you know, their turn and their right to get the lead, and for whatever reason, the drama teacher thought that my friend and I were the best suited for these roles. So that was Woody Allen's play, an early play, Don't Drink the Water, with the priest in asylum in the embassy, kind of like Cardinal Mincenti in Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
But I was well aware, and it was very funny, because I remember an older student who was this somewhat younger sister of my older sister's best friend running up to me after my audition and saying, you were hilarious, I hope you get the part. So it was this wonderful thing, but it slowly became a seminal part of my identity. That
clearly,
I wasn't a big sports guy. I wasn't on the football team, but I was part of the theater clique.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how was your family with this? Were they pleased to have a son who was, you know, an actor, or did they know?
I think they were good about it. I think they tried to be supportive. They came to all my performances. I think they were worried that a career in this field could be very unstable and that it was a career that had so many different variables that, you know, even if one had talent, it wasn't necessarily sufficient, that there were all sorts of elements of luck and timing. So they were concerned. They were not at all discouraging, but I don't think they were overly encouraging either. They just sort of were, you know, pleasant and probably secretly hoping that I would get over this.
Yeah, right. Okay, so high school, you're in the plays, and you do everything now. Did you dance at all? Oh, well, you took tap.
I took a little bit of tap, but not much had changed since the Nutcracker. It was still a good thing that that we weren't doing 42nd Street.
Yeah.
We were doing Guys and Dolls.
Right, right. Okay, so what it sounds like is that your commitment, that's not the right word, but your desire to be a performer was an evolving thing. You did it, and you got a lot of approbation for it, and you liked it, and so you did more of it, and then, right?
Yeah, it seemed to be something I was relatively good at.
And,
and
liked.
Loved, and I pursued it during college.
Hold on. Okay, that's my next question. So, you went to college. Did you go to college with the idea that you were going to study something theater-related, or did you...
I wasn't sure. I went to Yale College, which is an academic liberal arts school. It turns out that they had a very new, still young, theater studies major, which is what I wound up choosing as my major. But it's not a professional school, so it still is very different than going to a Juilliard or a school totally geared towards preparing people for a profession. It was a liberal arts education with, there might have been one or two little acting classes, but the emphasis would be more on theater history or theater literature rather than vocal projection or something technical.
Yeah, okay. So while you were doing this, what were you thinking about when you got out?
I thought that I would, after I got a college degree, I would come to New York and study professionally. And I was very fortunate that the residential dorm complex I lived in had attached to it a professor who was at the Yale School of Drama across the street, who was a very famous acting teacher in America. He was a man by the name of Robert Lewis. Everyone called him Bobby Lewis. He had been an original member of the group theater. He had helped to found the Actor's Studio. And he, Lee Strasberg, and Stella Adler, and of course by now all of them are gone, they were considered the three legendary master teachers still living. And so Bobby would sometimes come to my residential college and have lunch in the cafeteria, and we would chat. He knew that I loved theater. In fact, it turns out he lived in the town next door to my hometown. So sometimes if he were going home for the weekend, he'd give me a lift and drop me off in Tarrytown, and he would then go to Irvington. And he recommended, I said, well, you know, Bobby, what do you think is the best place for me to go to study professionally once I graduate? And even though he was at the Yale School of Drama, he encouraged me to go to New York and study with Stella Adler, whom he felt was the best of the best. He said, well, she'll probably tell you I'm the best, but don't listen to her. She's the best. So that's what I did. I came to New York, and I studied with the legendary Stella Adler for a year, which was very exciting. She was, I think, in her 80s then, but still, you know, totally with it. She still had platinum blonde hair, which was perfectly coiffed. When she taught, she sat on a prop stage, which had a pink gel focused on her. It was really something.
Uh-huh.
But she was inspiring. She would sometimes make us cry. I mean, this was 1977, so what is that, 40 years ago?
Mm.
I still remember many of the things she said to us. She would say, nothing in the theater belongs to you. You must give it away. Give it away. And one of the exercises, we should have you come stand on stage and say your name. And she'd say, look at you standing there. You look broken. You know, stand up and have presence. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah. And so did you think that you learned?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think most really good courses of acting are more than a year. I don't think you can learn everything you need to know in a year. And hers wasn't a complete course. So I took select classes there, and then I tried to fill that in with classes at other places.
Okay, so you were serious then. You were thinking, I'm an actor, and I'm assuming you had a day gig, so you could pay for this.
Yeah, I worked, right? I worked in bookstores and restaurants.
Right.
And
right, but you were focused. This is it. You were going
to
be an actor.
Absolutely. I came to New York to give it my all. And then, I don't know if you've had a chance to read all the book, but there was a major turning point.
Well, that's where we're going now. So what happened?
What happened was, towards the end of 7 years...
7 years of studying
and then
trying to get work.
Trying to get work.
Right.
I discovered an original script by a young unknown writer that had an incredibly exciting and challenging and almost terrifying role in it that I really was determined to play, because I realized you could only play this role by committing 110% and leaping off a cliff. There was no way you could...
Give it away.
You really had to give it away. And as I thought about it, how do I make sure that this play gets a production, and how do I make sure that I get to play that role, I realized the answer was I had to produce it.
Right.
So I produced it. I hired an attorney. I hired a general manager, little knowing that one day I would be a general manager. And I raised the money from friends and relatives. It was a very modest Actors Equity showcase, so we're not talking millions of dollars here. We're talking thousands. And found a director who accepted the fact that I wanted to play this role and was okay with that. And got the show on, and I think it was very reputable. But to my total surprise, at the end of the process, when the dust settled, I had to admit I was better at that other side. It was a better fit for me. It suited me, that kind of producing, organizational, administrative side was really a better fit for whatever my talents were than the performing side. And that was not what I expected, but it was incontrovertible. I mean, I couldn't deny it.
I love this. It's the willingness, really, to change horses midstream. You know,
switch horses.
That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Because you had new information about yourself. Right. A lot. You know, not everybody can do that.
Well, I sometimes say that it was as if I had always been a fish, but until that moment, no one had placed me in water. And I suddenly went, I'm a fish. I'm a fish.
Well, I love this, really. I love this. But it's not someone had placed you in water. You placed yourself in water.
I'd done it to myself.
You'd done it to yourself, yeah. And it was instinctive, right? You said, I have to do this, so I'll make this happen.
This
right?
is what I need to
this
do
is what
in
I
order
need
to do what I really want to do.
Yeah, right. And in the interim, you discovered what you really wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, I lecture on occasion, and I sometimes say to younger people, it's really important to have goals and to have a direction and to be focused, but just make sure that you don't have blinders on, because sometimes things come up by total surprise along the way, and you have to be open to those as well.
Yeah, this is a message I also resonate with, that the people who are most successful, and I do not mean that in a financial sense, are the people who are in touch with themselves and willing to be who they are. And as you describe, we don't always know that early on. And for some people, it takes them a long time, right? And some people never allow it. They stay with what they thought was right, or what somebody else told them was right, or they're right, right. The blinders that you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
And, right, go ahead.
Well, I also say, people would ask me at times, well, you know, how long are you going to spend seeing if it's going to work as an actor? And I would always say, oh, I don't know, but I'm sure I'll get a sign. And in my mind, the sign was always something positive, that I would get a contract, I would get a role. And so that's what I was looking for. And then when this happened, I said, oh, you know, maybe I've been getting the sign for a while, and the sign was I didn't get the role. But that wasn't the sign I was looking for, so I didn't see it.
It's right. It's great. It's great. Okay, so you have this epiphany. What do you do?
Well, at that moment, I thought what I really wanted to become was a producer. So I talked to people and did some research, and I realized that there were two things every single producer had to do, namely choose the piece and then raise the money.
Yeah.
And I didn't think either of those were things that could be taught. I felt choosing what you wish to produce is an expression of your personal taste, and I felt raising the money is salesmanship, which I always was great at. I always sold the most Boy Scout Christmas wreaths. I always won the newspaper drive. So I thought, okay, well, I'm not really concerned about taste and fundraising. But as I talked to people, it seemed that almost everything else a producer did was done very closely in conjunction with something called a general manager, this kind of mysterious, mystifying, if you will, role. So I decided, in order to become a really hands-on, nuts-and-bolts, informed producer, maybe what I should do initially is go to work for a general manager.
Yet again, right? You think you're going here, but you're actually going here, right?
Yeah, well, I was dimly aware that there were some people who were very wealthy, which was not my case at all, who just became a producer and they sort of bought whatever they needed. They hired a general manager and they bought the rights to a play and other people did all the work, and they really didn't have a high degree of knowledge about producing, but they could sort of afford to make it happen. And A, I wasn't wealthy. B, I knew if I became a producer, that's not the kind of producer I wanted to be. I wanted it to be someone who understood how things worked, how much things cost. So it seemed to me that a general manager was the key to discovering all of this. So I asked around and found out, got a list of general manager offices and found out that there was one highly regarded office that belonged to a gentleman named Albert Poland, who was looking to hire a second assistant. That was a way to get my foot in the door. They unusually had two new shows that were happening very close to each other, so there was a tremendous volume of work, and they needed more help. So I contacted them, had an interview, which seemed to go well. I was told, check back in about a week. We need to make a decision quickly because things are happening and there's a lot of work. And I made a note, check back in a week, write it down. And in a week's time, I hadn't heard anything, so I called to inquire, and the one assistant picked up, and he sounded really harried, and I could hear phones ringing, and he just sounded like there was a lot going on. And I asked if I could speak to Albert, and he said, he can't pick up the phone now, he's too busy, he's on a line, there are two calls holding, can you call back? And I said, sure. And he hung up, and then all of a sudden I remembered something I had read in a book about Katharine Hepburn, who I'd always admired, and she said, never call or write when you can go in person.
Right.
I thought, okay, Kate, I will take you at face value. I got up, I went straight over to the office, Albert Poland's office. I stood in the doorway. It was, I don't know if pandemonium is the right word, but it was extremely busy. Phones were ringing. Everyone was trying to answer them. Albert looked up from his desk, saw me looming in the doorway, said, oh, thank God, when can you start? I said, now. I walked in, I sat down, I answered a ringing phone, and he couldn't get rid of me. I sort of saw an opportunity, and I lunged for it.
Yet again, it's the same thing with the play. You saw the play, you said, this is right for me, and you went for it.
and I tried to make it happen.
Yes, you did. That was what I meant to say, that you were proactive in pursuing this thing that looked right to you, right?
Yeah, and then I had a wonderful, long stint at Albert's office. I'm probably in the Guinness World Book of Records. I think on the average he was able to keep an assistant 6 months, and I think I stayed there maybe close to 10 years. I mean,
wow.
I worked my way up the ladder. I started as the second assistant. Eventually I became the first assistant. Then I became the office manager. Then I was able to hook into a very important manager's union apprentice program. The union is called ATPAM, which is an acronym for the Association of Theatrical Press Agents and Managers. And I realized that company managers were employed in Albert's office, and that was a very respected and very important position. It was unionized, so it offered a decent living wage. It came with, because it was a union, an employer was required to make welfare contributions to a health plan and pension, and eventually over the years annuity. So I realized that was important for me to become a union member, and because office assistants are paid, I don't know, in those days, $400 or $500 a week, no benefits, and you know, it was fine initially, but as you get older, it's like, you can't live on that. You need, when you're young, nobody thinks about pension.
That's
but,
right.
You need to start contributing.
Well, wait. So I'm assuming, I don't think this is a big leap, that you actually liked what you were doing.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, right.
I loved it.
Right. So,
and
again,
I was good at it. It suited me.
Yeah, right.
I was organized. I was thorough. I was a good communicator. I could get along with people.
You found a bigger pond. For your fishness.
Absolutely.
All right.
The koi was able to grow.
That's right. And you knew it. Yet again, it's not just that you were looking for security, but you actually wanted to be what you were becoming.
Yes. I felt it was a good match for me.
Yeah. Okay, good. So you take this course in the union, you become a member of the union, is that?
It's a 2-year apprenticeship. You have to get a certain number of work weeks within a certain number of time. I do go into it in greater detail in Broadway General Manager. And then you have to take a fairly grueling, comprehensive oral and written exam administered by the union, because they really need to have some sort of quality control to make sure that people who are admitted have the knowledge and the experience. Every single position on Broadway is unionized. There are 16 different unions, guilds, societies. They all have work rules. And it's very important to know these work rules, because if a show is in violation, it's going to get fined. It's going to cost money.
Right.
So it's not an unfair exam, but it's a very thorough exam.
I'm assuming you passed it.
I passed it. It's a little bit like law school. People who are all apprentices and know that they're going to be taking the next exam, they tend to form study groups and meet once a week, starting months in advance, and they give each other assignments. Next week you speak about the ushers' union, you make a presentation, and you really bond closely. I'm still in touch with several people from my study group. One of them interviewed me at Barnes & Noble a couple weeks ago. There's another woman who's highly placed at the Schubert Organization, and we keep in touch. And the experience of the exam is so intense that we both still remember what we ordered for lunch that day in between the written and the oral part.
Wow.
I had a Reuben.
Okay, all right. So
at the Polish.
So essentially, it looks like you finally have found the right place for you.
Yes. I mean, I was a company manager for many years, and then I wanted different working hours.
Well, hold on. Let's go back to what does the company manager do, and how did it happen for you? I mean, now you're in the union.
Now I'm in the union.
So you can apply for jobs as a company manager. Is that what happens?
Yes. You can be on an available list. Like so many things in the theater, a lot is done by relationship. So the company manager works very closely with the general manager. So if you've done a show with the general manager and you've gotten along well and the general manager knows he or she can rely on you, they're likely to keep asking you back.
Right.
But the company manager is a bit like a lieutenant to the general manager. The general manager does the broad strokes and sets up the structure, and then the company manager comes
does
in,
all the work.
Does all the work.
Yeah, right.
Makes it happen.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you did that. You got on the company manager list?
Did that for many years.
How many is many?
I'm just going to hazard a guess, at least 10 years.
Okay.
Worked on many shows, got a lot of experience, but eventually I got married,
mm-hmm.
and for me, one of the drawbacks to a company manager's position is that you are tied to the show schedule. You have to stop in at the theater every performance 8 times a week, first to check in with the company to make sure that people are happy, they don't have questions, there are not any problems. And then once the show begins, you have to review the box office statement with the treasurers, because the treasurers are in the employment of the theater. They take in the show's money, but the company manager is the representative of the producer, and they have to make sure that the box office statement is accurate, because on a weekly basis, the money is then released to the production.
Okay. All right. So at some point, you said enough of this, and then what did you do?
I guess I put the word out that I really wanted an opportunity to general manage, and luckily someone I had known who thought well of me gave me that opportunity. And that was a producer named Ben Sprecher.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chance to sort of make that
rather seamless leap.
Yeah. Initially, he actually wanted me to be the company manager and the general manager, which is pretty grueling. And I did that for a couple of shows, but I finally realized it just was...
You weren't so young anymore.
I wasn't that young, and if you're doing both, then you are working 7 days.
You have no life, exactly.
You have no life.
Right.
So eventually I marched into his office and said something like, read my lips, I am never going to company manage and general manage a show again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was sort of willing to let me do that as long as he could get away with
it. Yeah,
me.
That's probably exactly right.
But he recognized something of the steeliness in my tone and said, okay, I get it. Because as somebody said, they're very different positions, and if you're doing both, you know, how do you go to the first day of rehearsal and go to a star and say, hi, I'm your general manager. Would you like cream with your coffee?
I see. Oh, my goodness. Well, all right. So I'm assuming then that he hired you as the general manager for the productions now.
He relied on me very heavily.
I'm sure he did.
For many years. And I worked in his office, and the relationship, as I go into a little bit in Broadway
mm-hmm.
General Manager, the relationship between a producer and his or her general manager is a very tight-knit, close...
Yeah, because you depend.
One.
They depend on you. I mean, really, it's not they can't, right? They can't have somebody that they don't trust to do whatever it is you're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, and most general managers have their own offices. Ben really wanted me to be a general manager in his office, so I was right there.
There.
I was, you know, 2 feet away.
Okay, so are you still general managing?
I haven't for a bit. I took a little hiatus, and then I had the idea for this book.
Aha!
And
now that's interesting to me. You had the hiatus first?
I had the hiatus first. I felt I needed a change. I felt that I'd been doing this a while. I knew how to do it. I was good at it. But something in me was saying...
Yeah, yet again.
Either you look for change or you just keep doing this over and over. And the thought of that didn't make me joyous. I thought, okay. I was just about to turn 60. I thought, I had been working on a wonderful show that got great reviews, that for whatever reason financially wasn't working, and it had to close early with losses, I thought, you know, you really need to give yourself the gift of sort of stepping back and taking time to reflect. And I hadn't really been happy. There's a lot of stress in managing a multi-million-dollar Broadway show, and particularly if the show isn't going well and you can't fix it and you're all trying everything you can think of. It's very stressful.
Oh, no, I'm sure it is. But yet again, you had the sense of what was right for you. A lot of people, I suppose you know, would feel like that and then think, well, too bad, I can't do anything about it, so I'm just going to keep doing this thing I hate for the rest of my life.
Well, thank you. I wish I could take total credit for the decision, but two things were key.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming home on a regular basis, and my wife would say, how was your day at the office, dear? And without thinking, I would just say, hateful.
Wow.
And that's not good. Too many hateful days, suddenly you're leading a hateful life. But the real kicker was our son, who was in college at the time, came home and said to my wife, who later reported it to me, he said, so just how unhappy does Dad have to get before he makes a change? And that horrified me. It horrified me that that's how my son...
How he saw you.
How he perceived my situation. I thought, God damn it, Peter, you know, if you can't take your own needs seriously, you know, you got to be aware of the example you're setting. So I said, all right, that's it. I'm taking a hiatus. I told friends I needed to put the schwa back into my vehicle. And then, you know, as I had time to reflect and to decompress, I had this idea for this book.
Yes.
I thought, you know, I love talking about what I do,
mm-hmm.
and I love teaching what I do. I lecture fairly often.
Mm-hmm.
And no book exists on this subject. It's really right after the producer, probably the second most important position in all of theater. I mean, the production attorney is very important, but in terms of the length and breadth of the general manager's role, I would hazard to say it's even more significant than the attorney.
Okay, so let's talk about the book. You think there's no book that says this.
There's no book out on the subject, which is so important. And then, this was a total surprise, but I suddenly remembered that I'd actually started to write a book about general management years before. Someone had approached me and said, why don't you write a book about general management? And this person had written a very successful book on producing. And they said, you know, you write the book, and I'll lend my name to it, and, you know, I'll get a third of the profits or something. And so I actually had started and tried it, but the project eventually withered on the vine. But I still had all my files. They were on the computer, and so I said, wait a minute, I've already started this book. So I went back and I looked at it, and I realized that practically nothing was usable from that earlier version, which was many years before, and which had been largely directed towards off-Broadway, which was where I had primarily been working at that time in my life. And I thought, well, I don't think I can really use any of these chapters, but now, since I have fairly extensive Broadway experience, I think more people are interested in hearing about Broadway. It's sexier.
Right.
It's more complicated, more complex. There are more unions, so there's more for me to discuss.
And there's more stories.
There's more stories.
Yeah.
Well, there are stories off Broadway too. But
yeah, but no. But this will have names that people recognize more.
Yes, I mean I.
That's the sexy part.
I've been very privileged to work with many top authors, directors, and actors and designers. So
yeah.
That's been a privilege.
Yeah. And it does. And it helps the book. It just does.
It's so funny. I will tell you, Lynn, when I thought I had written the book,
mm-hmm.
I showed it to a publisher and discovered to my chagrin that what I had written is commonly referred to as a first draft. But I didn't know. I just put down all my thoughts. I thought, okay, I wrote the book. So he said, well, it's definitely a first draft, but I think it has a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. So I said, would you be willing to have me come in and would you review the book with me chapter by chapter? And I'd like to write down all your notes and thoughts and then go away and work on them, which is what we did. But one of the biggest gifts he gave to me, because I thought I was primarily writing a textbook, he said, well, you know, this is about Broadway. I think you can afford to have a lot more fun with it and tell stories. And because I was a naive goose who had never written a book before, I said, oh, I didn't know I had permission to do that. I thought it was a textbook, and you couldn't do that in a textbook, and this isn't about me. This is about this body of knowledge I'm trying to convey. He said, no, it's Broadway. People who want to know about Broadway want to hear those stories.
That's so right.
I then went back, and part of what I did in an extensive rewriting in my second draft was add all those stories, and I'm grateful I did, because they're fun, and I think they offer first a contrast to the serious parts, and then hopefully also they can illuminate serious points in a sort of more fun, colorful way.
Well, you know, what I'm thinking is that they draw people in, so people can come for the stories, but then they get the other stuff as well.
Well, and conversely, I say to friends who are wonderfully happy for me that I've published a book and supportive and they buy it, I will say to them, you know, the book is primarily a very substantive, in-depth discussion of what a general manager does, but it's interspersed with personal anecdotes and bits of theatrical lore, which are fun, and they're clearly broken out from the text. They're easy to spot. So I want you to think of those stories as just the dirty parts from Lady Chatterley's Lover. And if you're reading a chapter on, say, insurance, and it's more than you ever wanted to know about insurance, just skim ahead for that next story.
It's great.
Just look for the dirty
just
parts.
Just go for that, yeah. But that is what draws people to I mean, except those people who are trying to be general managers, who would be reading the book because they wanted to be a general manager, everyone else is reading it with an eye towards the stories as well.
With the generalist point of view.
That's right.
Exactly. And initially, my thought was the book's target audience are people who want to become professional general managers. And with this layering in, I'm hoping that there also will be an audience of people who love theater and want to learn everything they can about every aspect.
And are curious.
And as I say, if I have to go into great depth for the potentially professionals, but if a certain section is more detailed than you want, just skim ahead to the next.
And if it turns out that somebody buys the book and only reads the dirty parts, so what?
Well, I thought the other day, when things calm down a little, I think I'm going to extract those stories and put together a little pamphlet called Just the Dirty Parts.
I love this. I think that's a great idea. So
I'll send you a version.
Please do. So so it turns out that you're a writer as well.
Yes. Yes. I actually have now started referring to myself as an accidental author.
Oh, no. No, no. No. You're just an author. It's not an accident.
Well, thank you. I guess like other things in my life that we've discussed.
Yes.
I never...
Surprise!
I am surprised. But I've been getting some lovely feedback, and I thought, okay, well, this is the only book I'm going to write. I'm writing about what I know.
As far as you know.
I'm embarrassed to say I now have two ideas for...
This is not...
Two additional books.
This, of course, is not a surprise, because it turns out, I don't know, maybe you're a frog. I don't, you know, because it's a new pond, right?
I was a frog in college. I was in Stephen Sondheim's The Frog.
Son of a bitch.
And I was singled out at one rehearsal for my ribbit and had to demonstrate it to Meryl Streep and Sigourney Weaver, who were graduate students.
Well, but you know what I mean. Is
yes.
that you, it's important to me, because it's a part of the reason I do the show, is that you are able to demonstrate the ability to evolve. I don't know what probably a fish doesn't evolve into a frog, but to be...
Tadpole,
right, exactly. To be in touch with what's important to you and then to follow it and to grab onto it, to have the courage, really, to grab onto it, whatever it is, right?
Thank you. The hardest thing for me, because it's not how I'm normally built, the hardest thing was to accept that I needed to take a hiatus. And of course, the first question everyone would ask me is, oh, what are you going to do?
Right.
And I had to learn that it was okay to say, I don't know.
Right.
I need to give myself space. I need to think. And I hope that it will be revealed to me. And that, for me, was really hard. It took tremendous courage.
I know it.
To say, I'm letting go, and I don't know what's next, but it's okay. It's going to be an adventure. It's going to be a demystification of its own kind.
Yeah, I do think it takes a lot of courage, and it's not just you. We live in a culture that is all goal-oriented, you know, that doesn't understand process at all. There is no process. There's just you figure out what you want to do, and then you do it. So that's part of your culture. So it's not just you, I think, anyway.
And I have to say, I have, like, the world's best wife whose primary concern was my happiness and well-being, and she was not at all concerned about income, finances. She just wanted me to be happier and actually to rediscover my more creative side. Because I had started out, as you remember, in fifth grade, I'd started out as a performer,
right,
as a singer.
Right.
And I'm having a lot of fun discovering my creative side, which was a little bit set aside for years. And I'm doing a lot of humorous writing.
Oh, lovely.
As well.
Yeah.
Which I amuse myself tremendously. I laugh all the time at what I've written.
All right, so I only have one more question, and it is, you know, it's interesting. Quite often, the people I interview have a through line. They decided to be an actor, and that is what they did, and you know, so. And it's, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because for them it was clearly correct. But so I'm able to ask the question in a way I can't ask you, because the question is usually, having spent a life doing this thing, what would you say about it? But I can't ask you that. So what I want to ask instead is, having allowed yourself to continue to evolve and discover more and more about who you are and what works for you, is there anything you would say about that?
I would say for me, it's been a great thing, and I would encourage other people to have the courage to let go, to introduce change, to explore. And I also think different things may be more right for an individual at different phases of their life.
Yes.
So something that was absolutely right for you at 30 may not necessarily be so at 50. And so I guess don't be afraid to evolve.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you,
Lynn. That was really lovely.
Don't be afraid to evolve. Words to live by. As I said in the opening, I interview people like Peter, people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And Peter, so clearly willing to be who he really is, even when it turns out that what he thought for a very long time, since the Nutcracker and Fagin, until he was almost 30, he thought it was acting that was his life's work. And then, because he allowed himself to follow the path that seemed right, he recognized that his fishness really was company management and then general manager, which he again did for many, many, many years and believed was his path. And then he had the courage, albeit with help. And we cannot underestimate the significance of the help of people who love you to encourage you to be who you are. So it is my hope, as always, that you are asking yourself, am I doing what I'm doing simply because I've always been doing it? Living out this identity simply because I decided it at some earlier time? Am I willing to consider that there's more to me than I previously thought? As always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you. Something that encouraged you to ask yourself those questions. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So